Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You're listening once again to another edition of Religion Means Alive. I'm your host, Imam Alfred, the host of Religion Means Alive, and this is a program put together, produced, directed, and sponsored by supporters of Imam Waruddin Muhammad, the rightful heir to the freedom movement. And this program is for Muslims, Christians, and Jews, particularly for the descendants of slaves here and formerly the wilderness of North America. We are honored and privileged beyond words on a very special day. And that day is the day that we as Muslims celebrate the day of gathering called Jama'ah. And it's auspicious, I say, because we have a great cause. He's no longer a guest. You see, if someone stays in your house over 3 days, they're no longer a guest. You put on the work. And our brother has the distinctions of being one of our finest minds. You know, I talk to brothers and they don't know why they be examining them. And it's only accidental because there's kind of a little professor in me, you know. And I listen. I said, this brother is well-read. One of the great attributes of Brother Minister Malcolm and the early leaders of the Nation of Islam were that they were well-read. You couldn't mention a periodical or a book that they hadn't read. And today, some of us have gotten so drunk on rituals that we can't read. We just can't. If not in explicit Islamic terms, we can't understand it. But this is not the case with our dear brother and dear friend, Brother Imam Yusuf Abdul Salam. I just want the audience to know that. I would love to see him in the sense of intellectual exchange. He's a constitutional law legal scholar, and our president is a constitutional legal scholar. And September, I believe it's in September of 2017, he's going to return to the classroom at the University of Pennsylvania School of Law. And I want to ask Brother Imam Yusuf Abdul Salam, a former law professor, a practicing imam and a practicing attorney, and obviously a practicing intellectual, but a socio-intellectual in the tradition of our Imam Waruddin Muhammad, in the tradition of our prophet, and in the tradition of the rich African-American intellectual preachers. What does he make of President Barack Hussein Obama returning to the classroom after finishing his term in the White House?
First of all, let me say Alhamdulillah, Allahu Akbar, for those very, very keenly analytical but heartfelt, gracious comments from you, Brother Imam. And you and I both know that we are all servants, and whatever skills that God has blessed us with, we have a duty like a soldier to sharpen our sword until it gleams. And I try to sharpen my sword, the sacred conversation, just like a private in the army, until it gleams. So, but I do appreciate you identifying that. Now to your question. Look, President Barack Hussein Obama is a world-class mind, constitutionally trained at one of the finest legal institutions in the world, Harvard Law School. Obviously had a deep grip on the legal phenomenon in this nation, because I can tell you, making good grades in law school is one thing, but being able to move up to the next level and become a member of law review is another thing. And to be able to move up to a level and become leader of law review is even another thing. And to do that as an African American at one of the most prestigious legal institutions in the world is indeed amazing and significant. It would be a waste if he did not take that mind back to some law school. If that's the case, the University of Pennsylvania, I'm not necessarily aware of that factually, but if that's the case, then that's a really a good use of his brilliant legal mind, and it puts him in great stead. Because once you become trained to think like a lawyer, you can deal with the analytical and critical concerns of any discipline. I just saw him finish up an interview. Ham, directing 50 nations as to how to deal with this very tricky global problem of having a strong anti-nuclear proliferation atmosphere on the globe. And he looked, quite frankly, more than just a constitutional scholar. He looked exactly what he is, the most impactful, hermetic political leader on this planet since Massa Musa. Only maybe two in the last 2,000 years in his class, Massa Musa and Hannibal, in terms of the political and governmental door of human life. So I'm certainly hope that he'll use that legally trained mind in the arena of constitutional law. But I also heard him say, look, I still plan to move the Mohawk a little bit. So that tells me that he has noble moral and spiritual aspirations beyond the presidency that will take up some of his time as well.
Let me ask you this. Is there any plan for Professor Yusuf Abdul, Imam Yusuf Abdul Salam, to return to the legal lectrum and conduct the class in law? Because I tell you, I have a son who has aspiration to the law. And I was saying that I hope in a summer class or somewhere we can get the better minds. I think, you know, Almighty God, Allah, blessed me to sit under the tutelage, first of Imam Wahdeen Muhammad, but I also sat under the tutelage of some of our great African-American thinkers, such as Sam DeWitt Proctor and Gardner Calvin Taylor and others. And I just think it's something for those of us who have gone beyond four decades to transmit our knowledge and our experience. You and I came up in a generation where we were told not to trust anybody over 30. And I almost got a right hook from Judge Robert L. Carter for saying something slick to him. And he threatened to hit me. And I thought I kind of shocked. I said, aren't you a judge? He said, yeah, but before I was a judge, I'm from East Orange. And several lawyers had to hold him back from knocking me on my behind because, you know, I just thought I was messing with this old man that, quote, and I, you know, I'm like 20, 22 years old, and I see him at a Boston conference. I just wanted to challenge. I had no basis other than stupidity. So I was wondering, did you have any plans to return to the classroom?
I'm torn with the idea. I tell you why. When I came out of undergrad school, I had been involved with various aspects of our people's struggle in America. When I went to law school, I fell in love with constitutional law because it took me to the Amistad decision, the Scott decision, Pleasants versus Ferguson, all those creeping assaults on Plessy versus Ferguson cases between Plessy and Brown versus Board of Education and beyond. So it was from studying those cases that I fell in love with constitutional law. Even though most of the time at Syracuse University, I taught property law, and on the upper level, Derrick Bell, Racism in American Law, which is not quite the same as constitutional law. It deals with the interface between African-American struggle for parity within the confines of the Constitution and the legal evolutionary doctrine that led to improvement in that regard. Constitutional law itself is much broader than that. Deals with economics, religion, finances, academia, every door that Jacob told his son about. You have to study it in order to be conversant with the broad scope of American constitutional law.
Okay, I am. So the answer probably is that you might possibly, because, I pray a lot that in the next 10 years, 5 years, that Muslims may have a law school, or we can take on responsibility to some of our African-American colleges that are having difficulty, and that we can bring our community where our community can be responsible for our own, for institutions in the African-American race. I want to move right along the line of self-help and move to the museum. There's a branch of the Smithsonian Institute, and I think this is a very powerful sign from Almighty God that the Alfred Street Baptist Church in Alexandria, Virginia, gave a $1 million donation to the Museum of African American History that's going to be a part of the Smithsonian Institute. And also the Lonnie Branch had the courage, the testicular fortitude, to tell the people that he was not going to turn down Dr. William Cosby's contribution, regardless of the allegations against him, and there are still those allegations. And I just don't understand, as a thinker and one who admires the law, how we can convict a man in the court of public opinion when he, in fact, has not even been tried in the court of law. There's probably two or three different angles. And as a sharp mind and as a person who is geared to teaching the common folk, you can tangle with that. It's, I hope I didn't throw too many questions, but I know you're sharp enough to catch them. That free question, I will sum them up. What do you think of Alfred Street Baptist Church giving the $1 million, then the fact that the museum was courageous enough to accept it, and they refused to accept public opinion against accepting Dr. Cosby's artifacts and all the contribution that he has made, the charges against him notwithstanding?
Well, first of all, any massive philanthropic allotment or allocation certainly should be applauded, and the people that were on the giving in of that philanthropic gift certainly should be commended, and that we should all express gratitude. And of course, anybody that document our history, that institutionalize our history, should be commended 365 days a year. I really don't believe there's a museum in the world that can contain and really present the most miraculous history in the history of mankind, other than that which occurred with Prophet Muhammad and his Sahabas for roughly, what was it, maybe 23 years. Other than that, the history of the African-American people in this country cannot find a peer anywhere. So, but we should applaud the effort to try to institutionalize, and I certainly hope that they are successful without a doubt. Now, as far as Brother Cosby, you know, corporate-based media has become, as one of their own said, an article by one by the name of Nicholas Kristof talked about earlier this week in the New York Times, quoted this journalist, I think Miss Curry, saying that the American corporate media have become drunk on sensationalism. And they are committing the sin of disrespect and contempt for our constitutional values. From the way they have blown up Trump to many others, the way they have allowed the institution of the presidency of these United States to be bombarded, assaulted, and unnecessarily blemished. Dr. Cosby is caught up in that general overall syndrome, where in order to pursue the sensationalism of ratings, they are willing to undermine his right to trial by jury and to blast and blow up into fragments the presumption of innocence, which is the key to American criminal jurisprudence. Three, they are willing to erode his personal constitutional rights without any conscience as to the cost and expense of that kind of wretched journalism in our country. So you see him being caught up in this general disregard and disrespect for the Constitution, being overly addicted on sensationalism in the big story. And unfortunately, Dr. Cosby has been a victim of that phenomenon. Look, the man has not been convicted of one crime. Did you hear me? He has not been convicted of one crime.
As they would say in England, hear ye, hear ye.
Not one crime. In an indictment, that's all it is, an indictment. It's not a conviction that established beyond a reasonable doubt that American citizen fully clothed in all the constitutional regalia has been convicted of a crime beyond a reasonable doubt. It's just not there. So I don't think anybody should preclude Brother Cosby from enjoying any commendations, from experiencing any achievements, from precluding from receiving any honorariums or any other acknowledgments of his service. The man has not been convicted. If there is a series and multiple serial convictions, then maybe the museum has a right to act retroactively. But until that time, until Brother Cosby is convicted, we need to respect the legal process, clothe him in the presumption of innocence, and let a trial by jury of his peers find him either guilty or innocent. That's the bottom line, Brother Mel.
Are you free to discuss state politics? State of Alabama?
I'm free.
You're
to
a free man of the city, right? Free man of the country.
I'm a free man of this city. But at the same time, you know, I'm a man with a very burning, fiery tongue. But let's say if my good friend Imam Afrit got caught up in a jam, out of a sense of respect for the relationship, I wouldn't burn your clothes out off with a blazing critique. You feel me? I would take a stand on principle, but I would be very, very circumspect of the prior relationship. But yes, I'm free to talk about Alabama politics.
You know what? Within that context, I'm going to withdraw the question I have because I believe you know the sitting governor, and I'm going to tell you the truth. I don't relish this kind of "I got you" politics. I remember years past, this kind of thing would 30, 40 years ago, pre-Watergate, we wouldn't have known anything about his personal life. And really, that's between him, God, and his family. And even between him and that's his family. I don't have it. I would roll.
Let me say this about that. Governor Bentley was almost like a seatmate of mine when I was in the state house. We had a very, very good relationship. At no time did he give any overt or covert actions that would suggest he was anti-Islamic. But when he was sworn in as governor of the state of Alabama, to me, he made his chicken come home to roost mistake. By that I mean he precluded the Muslims from being part of the family of Abraham. And he went out of his way doing it. Now, Governor Bentley knew me and the Adamic example that I had set in the example of Islam, bringing in imams from all over the state to make prayer and remarks in the state house. He's sitting up in there, the majority of the members clapping and ovation style response to these imams making prayer. So with that kind of exposure, he had no excuse. So in that sense, from the time I observed that mistake, I just felt that the unswerving law of wrath, yeah, there's the rule of mercy, and a law is prescribed in that. But secondarily, there is a secondary law of wrath, divine retribution. And they wouldn't put it past my reasoning to think that he might be reaping, in a sense, what he sowed. Now, I would say that about my son, about my brother, so I took it easy. I didn't really get into all the hypocritical dimensions of the alleged behavior. But again, he's innocent too, until proven guilty. But we don't have a smoking gun tape out on Dr. Cosby the way we may have with Governor Bentley. But that's the only evidence. It's not conclusive. It doesn't conclusively establish guilt.
Yeah, I'm glad you clarify that relationship with you and the governor. And it is hypocritical, and it is highly charging. I mean, you know, I know a high United States, well, this guy's not official. His daddy was one of the highest United States senators. Well, and he made a comment to a friend of mine, a mutual friend, that he would gin the base up. And they asked, he said, so this friend of mine asked him, this is a Caucasian, said, who are you going to vote for? He said, I'm going to vote, you know, I'm voting for President Obama. This is two Caucasians talking together. But he had just gone out the day before and ginned the base up. I think that's very hypocritical to gin the base up and then come and later on become brotherly. I just think that's hypocritical. Now, you explained the governor, and I can see his wrath. You know,
One of the things is that normally you would be looking at a surefire impeachment from this situation. But there's certain peculiar ongoings in Alabama politics that make that possibility somewhat unlikely. You see, an impeachment proceeding must be generated by the Speaker of the House.
Oh,
currently, the Speaker of the House is embroiled in, I think, 23 counts of possible criminal activity against him. I think Governor Bentley may be scheduled as a positive or a supportive witness in those cases. So not only do they have a political governmental relationship, Governor Bentley is intertwined in the actual legal predicament of the Speaker of the House. So one can just about predict that the Speaker of the House is going to try to block any impeachment proceedings. If, however, that does not happen, you have a House full of Democrats that have been completely castrated politically and legislatively, haven't been able to accomplish anything in 8 years. If a considerable minority of Republicans are able to institute those proceedings, then you can just about believe that the Democrats will be so aggressive, I'm assuming, and proactive to get something done, they could join with this minority group of Republicans and possibly conclude the deal. But that's only speculation. You have to pass the hurdle of getting past the powerful gavel of the Speaker of the House in this situation.
Let me ask you this, whether or not, I recall on this show you saying that one of the governors, I don't want to name the governor, I don't think I remember who the governor was, that some immigrant Muslims offered the Quran to this particular governor, and he said, thank you, but I'm already a student of the Quran.
Your memory is very impressive, brother, ma'am. I made that statement a couple of years ago when we first formed this limited partnership. But look, what happened was this. In the country of France, they had legislated away the right for Muslim women to wear the hijab at one point, I think. Well, in Alabama, two Muslim sisters went to try to get their driver's license, but they were wearing their hijab, and they didn't want to take it off. So someone in the hierarchy passed an administrative ruling, not provision, it was not a legislative provision precluding not just Muslim but all religious women from wearing a covering on their driver's license. There is a joint legislative body in the legislature where they come together to deal with special problems, House and Senate. And the Muslims around the state contacted me. I brought them down for a meeting in the state house. We met. I suggested certain strategic moves. Those moves were taken. I met with my colleagues. They say we'll handle it. And they did handle it. They neutralized and repealed that administrative provision, gave Muslim women in the state of Alabama rights that some states now would probably take away. In order to crown that achievement, because the Governor Bob Riley supported that joint legislative action, we arranged a meeting with him. And these fellas, not consulting the guy who had got them there. When I went on the Hajj, I didn't strike out on my own, running around Mecca like I knew the turf and the territory. I used intelligence. I followed the guide and their understanding of the situation. But once we got a little recognition and a little victory, they want to take over. They had consulted me. I would have told them, look, this little ritual is not appropriate. We don't have to hand this man that's leading the state of Alabama a copy of Quran. But they didn't consult me, so they brought it in. We were discussing matters. I was talking to the governor. You know, they all chest poked out. Now can meet with a Caucasian and ready to Jim Crow their second class African American brother in terms of respect. And so while we were talking, one of them bust out with a Quran, the paper Quran, and presented it to the governor. Of course, the governor was gracious, but he told him point blank, look, I appreciate this, but I already studied Quran. If you understand this culture, you can just about believe that there's not a governor or a prominent political official in this country that's not thoroughly familiar with Quran. So I think that's the incident that you're referring to, Brother Imam.
Yes, I am. I'm referring to that. And if my memory served me correctly, many years ago I visited the Supreme Court, and I looked up, and Muhammad is on top of the Supreme Court. So these Muslims that come here, I'm going to now ask you to comment on a statement by Imam Waruddin Muhammad. And one of the last statements I was living witness to, and he was asked about the immigrant Muslims. I just got to say this because this is a big, big, huge problem for us. And, Brother Imam, will you excuse me while I indulge myself for a moment? I don't like to have somebody, I'm interviewing somebody. I hate to be on a radio talk show and somebody talks longer than I do, but I get to set this question up. It's too many African-American Muslims have been trained, educated well by Imam Waruddin Muhammad, that are willing to take second-class citizenship, perhaps on the back of a camel or even on the back of a donkey. And now Almighty God has invited us to first-class citizenship in the global community. But Imam Muhammad said the immigrant Muslims, he didn't say some, is here as the snake in the garden. And it seemed to me, with all the great work, and he also said, I didn't hear him say this, but I heard him say that, he said they're here to take our places. And it's amazing that in the state of Alabama, where we had to fought, and some of our people actually died, our cattle was killed in Pell City, Alabama. And I think some brothers probably was killed in Alabama, Muslims pioneering to bring Islam to Alabama, and for the audacity, and this is, well, we just saw it, well, I didn't mean to go on, because I just got me pissed off, please forgive me, that an African-American sister in Mississippi is facing life imprisonment now because she let an immigrant Muslim give her a version of Islam that had her to forsake her rights in Mississippi. And she followed an immigrant right on, got married to him, which I'm against, and then ended up on her way to the federal penitentiary. So I raised a whole bunch of complex questions with it, but I have to tell you, brother, ma'am, I'm emotionally disturbed now, because that sister just came to mind. Innocent African.
Well, let me just say this. This is the day of Juma, and ironically, I just taught a group about the day, and I was trying to remind the brothers of the history of the Selma Islamic Center. There has been a series of attempts to undermine that masjid. It was glowing beautifully, and all of a sudden immigrants coming from everywhere, strange Greeks bearing gifts of want to help you and blah, blah, this and blah, blah, that. You know what I'm saying. End up being a very destructive force. But I told the brothers today, you can bring me the most brilliant scholar in the world and bring him up here to the Selma Islamic Center. He would not be suited to lead us. Now, I know some in your audience and some of the brothers, but he... little baby boy, give me another daddy type folks. They get shook when you say something like that. If he was really that brilliant, what he would do, he would pull the imam aside and say, look, the better part of wisdom tell me that I'm not familiar with the landscape here. God has given me something to make a contribution with. Brother Imam, do you mind if I stand by your side and be a resource to support you in leadership? And by no means, don't even look at me in the framework of a lead over this community. Just treat me as an enlightened but distant supporter. If he really brilliant, that's what wisdom would tell him. He wouldn't wanna leave. So no, we should never give in. Not after what God gave us with the leadership of Imam Muhammad. After 300-400 years of being reduced to secondary minds. And if God is a just God, and he is, he would give us a chance to have independent insight, intelligence, and spirit, and we don't have to be tutored or mentored by any other sons and daughters of Adam. If he's a just God, that's the justice that we deserve, and we got it with Imam Walter D. Muhammad, even though these weak-minded, give-me-a-daddy folk, they were not strong enough to embrace that. But many of us were, and we thank Allah for that great gift in terms of the leadership of Imam Muhammad and his father as well. His father was that kind of independent, strong mind, a rare man in history. And he was not, his mind was not replete with deep understanding of cosmic revealed Quranic science, but he was a man of wonderful wisdom. And he wanted Islam as it emerged and evolved from the soul of black folk. I'm talking about the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Now, certain ministers under him still want to say that we need to still be independent of Quranic teacher. No, we need to be independent of a immigrant daddy who tried to come over here and tell the imam that he should allow them to be our fathers in this religion. It's shameful, and I just thank God that he's given us a better option And believe me, we ought to exercise that option.
Yes, sir, I'm going to move right along, but I kind of want to, before I move along, I'm going to talk about the political landscape. I want to, I got two questions coming to my mind. I'm going to go back here because sometimes we need to do a refresher. I know in the early years we were together, and we've been together almost 3 years now, I believe 2 to 3 years. You had said you were in Montgomery, that's the capital of Alabama, for some may not know it, and you were waiting to get your law license, and you stopped in the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, and you witnessed a picture there.
Yeah, that's
to me,
right.
It was a picture. Will you share with the audience what you witnessed? And it came
I had just come to the black belt, and unlike most lawyers, when I came out of law school, I was trained in an advanced degree and went right into teaching law. Never did they take the time or have the time to take a bar. When I left academia and decided to actually practice law, I came to Alabama and I had to take the bar. The Alabama Judiciary Building is right across the street, from Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. After I turned in my paperwork, my application, I said, well, hey, I've never been in this historic church. Let me go in. And you couldn't enter the upper part, the sanctuary.
You tell our audience that may not know what the historical significance of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church and some of the illustrious pastors who had pastored that church and that relationship to the history of our people.
Well, that's a church that was once a part of what was called First African Baptist Church that was built by ex-slaves. They had a pastor by the name of Andrew Stokes, and he had a do-for-self philosophy. So they went around Montgomery and picking up bricks, and they built that church by a brick-a-day strategy. After the church became strong and established, now Abernathy ended up pastoring First Baptist, but there was a situation where the bourgeois members did not like to go outside a certain door when it rained because their Sunday go to meeting clothes would be muddied. So because of that, they broke off from the original First Baptist Church, and they went up the hill right across from the state capitol, and they built the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. Fast forward 60 or 70 years later, the great African-American scholar in the late to mid-40s, Vernon Johns, one of the most, probably, if you really know his history, probably the most brilliant African-American theologian this country ever produced, bar none. We understand the range of his scholarship and his learning, no doubt about. Even though we produced some brilliant theologians, Thurman, Johnson, Benjamin Mays, and many others. But I think he had it. But he became pastor of Dexter Avenue Baptist. But he had a problem because he was very down to earth. He used to get products and sell them after church, like the Muslims do, fish and watermelon. And again, this church with a long history, a bourgeois mindset, resented him, even though they respected his scholarship. But in time, he lost a position in Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., I think around about 53 or 54, replaced him. And he was the pastor of that church when the movement started in early December 1955. That's basically the history of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. Now, for the incident, I left and went across, entered the church. I talked to a secretary. But as soon as I passed the preacher's study, right by his door was a picture of Dr. Martin Luther King in heaven, some artist at Morehouse. Now, this professor taught at Morehouse, but pastored the church, was in heaven. The man was still living, and Dr. King was praying for the success of Imam Muhammad's mission on this earth. Now, the author I read the name was not a Muslim, but what that did for me is to make me run back to Selma, where there was no masjid, where there was not any organized Muslim activity, and push hard to bring the work of the Imam to Selma, Montgomery, and this black belt. That's how I ended up going into politics and everything else in that state, because I felt that that picture was a sign that it was time to bring the Imam to Alabama.
You were also, I suspect, helped by the fact that Dr. King's closest aide, and he, this is Dr. King's word, these are not my words, his closest friend, now he had a lot of friends, the great Dr. C.T. Vivian that I knew very well, and many others that he was very close to, Reverend Joseph Lowry, but one of his closest associates, David Abernathy, came to Chicago at the New World Patriotism Day and said that his leader, that I followed Martin, and now I am here to say that my leader is Imam Warak Deen Muhammad. Now, a lot of us don't understand this because what means he took a shot at Dane. No, it didn't mean that. Imam Muhammad, now this is you Muslims, I want y'all to listen and listen closely. Imam Muhammad, when he had left the leadership of his father, said, and this is public, this is on the record, he said, I am now going to remain Muslim. And they said, who will your leader be? He said, my leader will be Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Now, this is, again, on the record. This is a period of time Imam Muhammad told the press. Now, you all need to know this. But so just because someone says that they are following somebody doesn't mean that they follow that particular religion. I mean, people follow people, and they don't necessarily mean they follow everything they do. But Dr. Ralph David Abernathy stated in Chicago on Michigan Avenue, I forget the year, and isn't that true? I want you to confirm that. So I don't want the people to think you're a lawyer and you know evidence rules or evidence introducing facts. I don't want the people to think I'm just grabbing something out of the air because, you know, along that line, I was thinking about Dr. John. And said, Dr. John said, he asked him, said, Dr. John, I'm running out of sermons. And Dr. John said he didn't have any records of any of his sermons. So I'm glad we have this on tape. And the children, young people can look at it years from now, and this is all, they can go to the record. So, Brother Imam, will you confirm or deny that, what I just stated, that Dr. Ralph David Abernathy told the people publicly, not privately, that Imam Muhammad was...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I said I want you to confirm or deny that, what I just stated, that Dr. Ralph David Abernathy said that Imam Muhammad was his leader.
Before I do that, let me amplify on the statement that you made about Dr. Johns. Dr. Martin Luther King was running out of materials to speak on. And everybody in our intellectual tradition, in terms of theology, respected Johns. So he went up to where Johns was supposedly living and found Johns. He was an old man and he was somewhat out of it, and Dr. King asked him for a written package of his sermons, and Dr. Johns told him, hey, they all went up in the air, meaning that he didn't record them or write them down or publish them. But back to your statement, yes, not only did he make that statement, he wrote a biography, and the people got upset with him because he made some negative statements about some of the activities of Dr. King. But what he was doing was he was supporting his leader, Imam Muhammad. And he knew that as long as our people had this otherworldly, saintly image, non-human image, godly image of Dr. King, they wouldn't look at any other leader, Imam Muhammad or anybody else. So he said, well, I got to bring Martin down to human dimensions, let our people understand that God lives, though Martin have died, and that he can send just as good or even better leaders than Martin. So he wrote that book. But because he was dedicated to that proposition that Imam was his leader, the world tried to send him to his grave in ostracism. Now, I'm in Selma. Every civil rights person involved back then can't have been to Selma, and I met with 99% of them. Very rarely in public do you hear the name of Ralph David Abernathy mentioned. And it's because of the fact that if you bring attention to him, you bring attention to the Imam Muhammad and his wicked forces that want to keep him in a Joseph-like imprisoned situation where the people don't know about it. But God bless Brother Abernathy. In that sense, he was sincere. He knew he was not a leader. He knew he was a good supporter. And Martin was not around, so he looked for another decent man to support. Yeah, he had the mantle of leadership, but his heart was in support. And unlike many of us, he didn't have just a drunken big head for leadership. He looked around, he saw Imam Muhammad, and he said, that's my man. Now, I've seen Andrew Young at the Atlanta Masjid. He's one of Dr. King's lieutenants. He sends out emanations of general support of our mission, but he never did come forward while Imam was living. He knew about him and stipulate clearly and unequivocally that Imam Muhammad is my leader. So we can't underestimate the strength that Brother Abernathy to do that.
No, this is an ordained Baptist preacher in the order who could have and did receive the wrath of his people for doing it. Now, this is public. This is not private. Because, I mean, I'm going to have, I'm nowhere near you in the law, but I do know something about evidence. We're going to have another person here going to testify. He was an actual witness for all the great leaders of African America stood at Rosa Parks' funeral and told Imam Muhammad of his leadership. And I'm including, now we're going to, political figures and others. They'll say that in private, but none of them will say that in public. In private, I don't know of any of the leaders, and you and I both know these leaders. They all would tell you, from Cornell West, that y'all know publicly, all the way to Brother Minister Malcolm, that most of us don't know, but I know his followers. I didn't know him directly. They all said that Imam Wardeen Muhammad was the leader, the leading force. I mean, Carmichael, Kwame Ture, all of them. But we're going to have a brother on the program shortly. It could be a surprise treat that was accompanying me, Imam Muhammad, when the big boys, I'm talking the big black preachers, said, you were with us, In Sea Caucus, when Reverend Shuler, I have to bring this to our people's attention because our people really just don't know what we have. And I don't say we have. Imam Muhammad has given us a body of knowledge that makes us superior to anybody walking the earth. In fact, anybody who's walked the earth has not gotten the understanding. I'm going to repeat that no one has walked the earth who's gotten the understanding that Imam Muhammad got. Because God compensated us for all that suffering because we remain in our human form. Brother Imam, you're going to comment on that, and then I'm going to move to something.
Well, I tell you another one. You just mentioned him earlier. We saw the articles in the Muslim Journal where Imam acknowledged Bill Cosby in a big way. almost suggested that he was looking to Bill Cosby for moral leadership. Then Bill Cosby, Dr. Cosby, excuse me, reciprocated by telling key people throughout our little cultural network that if we want to solve certain problems, we need to take a look at the Muslims. After that, all hell broke loose for Dr. Cosby. He was playing the show. I don't know what kind of bias that he was going to put in that show. I don't know whether he was going to have some little signal enhancing Muslim life as something to consider in America. All I know is as he got closer to getting ready to release that show, all hell broke loose, and it's been one thing after another. Now, his co-actor, or actress, Phyllis Rashad, she indicated very quickly, built bam, thank you, ma'am, quick statement, that it may have been some hanky-panky to stop that show. Then she left it alone and went on about her Hollywood business. So we see two examples where these devilish forces made an example out of folk to keep them from publicly proclaiming Imam. They brought a whammy down on Abernathy, and they brought a whammy down on Dr. Cosby. Now, what are all these other entertainers and folks thinking? Athletes. No, I better not say, yeah, he was a good man, but I better not say a word because I'm going to have to pay the same price. Don't you know that all of our icons, cultural icons out there got some kind of skeleton in the closet? Don't you know these people have been studying everybody for years, including you and me and anybody else? They've been doing that. And so anytime they want to bring some little bones out the closet on any of us, they can find a way to do that. And they just sit there with these bag of bones until somebody boldly step out, like Cosby, like Dr. Abernathy did. Then they swiftly move to destroy them. Now, that's my considered opinion on that.
Well, it's a very learned opinion. It's not something by accident. I know some of the big stars. In fact, Imam Muhammad had said in private about some of these people not to burden them, because if they come out for him. But here's what is worth the challenge for you and I, as supporters of Imam Muhammad, and I'm a follower of Imam Muhammad, I'll say that, because, you know, people, well, you follow Imam Muhammad, well, you follow the Sunnah of the Prophet Muhammad. Yes, who led me to the Sunnah of the Prophet? Imam Muhammad. And on the Sunnah path, or highway robbers, all kinds of people can be found on a path. If you don't have a leader, even on the path itself, you can be snatched off the path. Now, enough for that one. I think we've given enough attention to this. I think we should go to some of the hot-button political issues. What do you make of the interview? And I want to ask you, did you see the interview of Chris Matthews and Mr. Donald Trump, the president of the Trump Organization? Now, Mr. Trump probably called me, I don't know what he would call me, but I'm not going to ever stoop to the level of calling him anything but the president of the Trump Organization. He has no political office, so he will remain Mr. Trump. And Mr. Chris Matthews, I think, did a splendid job of interviewing him. What do you think of that?
Well, initially, now see, if you recall, and see, a lot of orchestrates things. About 6 months, 6 weeks ago, we started hitting the American press on this show. Now, we're not to try to suffer from the delusions of grandeur like Chris Matthews heard the show. But what happens is once you're out of faith, throw ideas out in the atmosphere. Allah got a way of circulating them so that they get home and they start becoming a factor. And the last week to 10 days to a good portion of the American press have started reversing themselves. And now you can see it in a big way. Chris Matthews, about, I would say, a month ago, had Donald Trump on his show, and he was eating out of Donald Trump's hand like a little baby boy. Now, Chris Matthews, he has great analytical, journalistic skills, and the name Hardball, which is the name of his show, he knows how to play hardball. But when they were caught up in this game out of money increasing ratings, he softballed Donald Trump. And Donald Trump anticipated, well, hey, I'll go on Chris' show. I'm going to get some more softballs. But he didn't know that Allah had already moved this thing on him. And he got caught napping. And he went on there, and Chris Matthews went into his superb journalistic tricks. And before he knew it, Chris Matthews had disgraced him before the world. It's no way now any serious thinker will ever view, I'm not going to say Mr. because they don't call Obama Mr. Obama this and Obama that. So you call him Mr., I'm going to say Trump. No one is going to ever, after that Matthews interview, it's almost impossible now for any halfway decent journalist in America to take Trump seriously. And they are bashing him now in terms of critiques that they would nowhere near have done 2-3 months ago, 4 months ago, 5 months ago. He had the same mind. He had the same ignorance. He had the same lack of knowledge. But they insulated him and they protected him. But he kept picking at Muslim. He kept picking at Islam. He kept picking at Allah's people. So the Creator himself had to range counter forces that gripped him before the world. And we saw that live, but we don't connect up Allah with none of this stuff. We think a man can talk about Muslim sincere believers risking them getting killed and murdered in America by some kind of fool. I saw a woman at a Walmart and her daughter, and this strange man was looking at her. Wasn't no male there to protect her and that child because she had a hijab on. And Trump out there stroking at her. You don't think Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is going to protect these innocent Muslims in America? Oh, yes, he will. Now, we can talk all this Quranic and Islamic talk and expect for it to be applied on Mars or somewhere in space and don't look to see it right here, live and living color. Right. Allah disgraced Trump, and he used a man who he had prepared all the way back to Holy Cross, where they had to study that abortion issue, where they had to break it down. And Chris Matthews, I heard one of his brothers who was an Irishman say, he was explaining how Chris Matthews had been prepared all his life to give that interview. So God selected the right man with the right preparation, just like he told Moses, here you came prepared as a Dane, O Moses. Well, that moment was prepared for Matthews. And he stepped up to the plate and he hit a Babe Ruth type clout home run. And he made Donald Trump look like a fool.
And I think I only call him that. You're right. And let me tell you something. I'm getting sick and tired. I've heard Muslims calling President Obama, the elected president, an answer to their parents' prayers. In fact, my daddy would probably die and go back to heaven if he even thought an African-American was in the White House as something other than a janitor. We couldn't conceive of that.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, Brother Man. That's right. Yes, sir. I'm sorry about that, but it's so sad. It's almost comical. That's the only way we'd have gotten in the White House with Jonathan. I'm sorry for interrupting.
And my dad, I know him because he's the one who taught me about politics. He would have been calling him Mr. President, sir. You know, to see I never forget my dad taking me to a courthouse to see an African-American lawyer in Lynchburg try a case. And my daddy was, you know, I mean, to see that and to think that our parents, I mean, my dad would have been 100-some-odd years old. He was no more than 20 years away from slavery. You know, my grandmother would just died. I mean, if they brought her back now and said, Lula, there's a black man, there was a colored man as the president of the United States, she would look and they would just all fainted. They just couldn't believe it. But see, some of them would have believed it because in faith they saw that day would come. Now, well, I don't see what's wrong with us. And I know that they would have been happy to see somebody explain. My dad's the other one, Gaynor. I didn't mean to do this talking. I don't know, the spirit's hitting me. But you know, when I fully shared with him the precious knowledge I'd gotten from Imam Muhammad, my dad, he was a natural debater. He debated for fun. I mean, some other people play baseball, but he used to join the debate club. And when I told him a couple of the secrets of what Imam Muhammad had taught us, he said, well, boy, I knew this was going to be the last time I saw him. Alive, when he said, well, boy, you know more than I do. And I said, oh, God. I said to myself, this is probably the last time I see my daddy. Because he would debate to the last second. We're really for fun. We enjoyed it. But sacrifice, I just can't understand an African-American. And that's, you know, while we're on this subject, that's probably one of the reasons that Senator Sanders has had such a difficulty trying to persuade the African-American vote. I don't think it was so much a pro-Hillary Clinton vote, Secretary Clinton vote, as it much it was that when Senator Sanders brought Cornel West, who had made it his business to bash the president. I mean, just bash the president out of envy and jealousy and bureaucratic pleasure. And it's nothing but envy and jealousy. You know what I told an African-American? I said to him, why doesn't Cornel West tell the president of Princeton, a Union Seminary, what he told the president of the United States? He's happy to be tucked in into a chitlin plate in some hole in the academic walls of some Caucasian, but yet he wants to demand political redress from the president of the United States and the institution that he's in. That's the same thing go for Dr. Khalil Muhammad. I love him. But I tell these men to their face, that which you demand of the president of the United States, demand it of your own institution, see whether you be on the street collecting tin cans.
There's no doubt about that.
You've been in the academic world. You know how that world operates.
Hey, you better stick to it. They want you to write a certain way or you're not going to get what's called tenure, which is a check and control on your independent intellectual freedom. They can deny it all they want to. You're going to write what you think is going to get you tenure, what's going to be approved as a dissertation. You can chuck and jive and talk all that bluster, but that's the bottom line. Look at the contrast. Look how Allah has heightened these contradictions. You got Ham talking to the civilized world about this nuclear power. And the same time, Donald Trump acting like a little candy boy, like he passing out a candy bar. We're going to give a Trump nuke to Japan, a candy bar. I'll take this candy bar, Korea. And what these people, Japan said, look, we were almost destroyed by a nuclear weapon. We had a disastrous nuclear accident at Sendai. What in the world is man talking about giving us a nuke? Korea said, we don't want it. So not only did Chris Matthew make himself look like a fool on Chris Matthew, he's looking like a fool before the world because Allah allowed 50 world leaders to come over here and say, tell everybody, but especially the president, we shiver at the possibility of this ignorant man becoming president of the United States. But Allah is not going to let him get anywhere near the White House unless he come in as a janitor.
And you can take that to the bank, because one of his ardent supporters said he got a mental case, Ann Coulters. Now, you know, if Ann Coulters and Essie Cupps is beginning to condemn you, you got some serious problems.
Look,
and Glenn Beck,
78% of women in America detest him. 93% Latino. Just those two demographic stats there make it super scientific impossible for a person to win president of the United States. Not count African Americans, not count other folk, not count white folks not going to vote against them. 58% of the Republican Party, the Pew poll came out and said that they would not support him. 38% would, 58% would not. Okay, so who opened the eyes of these people? Yeah.
Isn't Senator Cruz, a fellow lawyer, isn't he worse than Donald Trump?
No, he's not worse than Donald Trump, but he's dragging on his coattails. He's pretty close. But I'm be honest with you, we may have a different view. I've never seen a public figure in America make the kind of progress that Trump made before he was finally busted. That was the most...
you don't have no argument. I agree with you. I just am amazed that he's gotten this far. But I think I figured it out. I think the networks have wrung as much as they can get out of him. And they decided now at the end to bring him down. Because, I mean, this guy, this last interview, this guy has been proven. Here he is taking everything that was sacrosanct and throwing it away. I mean, that's what the whole point of nuclear proliferation treaties is to stop the spread of nuclear weapons. And he had no answer when people said that the Saudis start selling T-bills and the Chinese start selling T-bills, this country would be broke overnight. So this man is totally irresponsible. Is he entertaining? I'm going to ask you the question. You are an examiner of facts and then the trial facts. Do you think the man is just basically insane, or what is he doing? What is his?
I think he had wise men like Roger Stone and others who knew about the fact that a certain percentage of the Republican Party had been geeing up to an insane anger against Barack Obama. And he was told, not now, but a few years back, that you can ride that and get a third of the Republican base to support you. And if it's multiple candidates, you could become the front runner. So he tested this theory with this birth idea against Obama. People forget that. There was a trial run to see whether or not this alleged base was out there. And they bid on it. And he became convinced that it was out there. So then he decided to run. What has become clear now is no matter what he says, this one-third of Republican voters and others are going to support him because they're not concerned about these other issues. Can he give me salvation from America that's being ran by Ham, by an African American? That's all they're concerned about. Now, I'm going to give you an anecdotal situation. There's a young man I know, and I got to get ready to go, in Birmingham. I know him. He was talking to me on Easter. I went up there to eat with him. And he said, well, you know, I work in this place. These white girls start coming to me talking about they fishing. I said, well, what are they fishing for, young man? He said they fishing for a black man. And he said he asked them, Well, why are you fishing for a black man? Because I want a super seed. Yeah, right. Well, what you meant by a super seed? A Barack Obama or Stephon Curry, that great basketball player out in San Francisco. But then they got changed to politics, and it came up to who they support. All the Donald Trump supporters. So they got this wild, stereotypical prejudice idea about getting a super black, but at the same time they racist generally against black folk and are ardent Trump supporters. That's how insane this thing is out there, brother. Man,
can your brother
that's
explain
how crazy
this?
It is.
I'm not getting this. But then I do get it. I think I get it. I've seen white women snatch black men up and tell them that I'm going to holler rape. And if you get caught with me, I'm going to still holler rape. If you don't give in to me, you can call rape. So perhaps that's also, it seems to me that's what's driving a lot of Donald Trump's machoism. Just the fact
they hate Obama, but the inconsistent, they see him as some kind of super seed. And if they have a seed from a black man, that they would have a child like that. But yet they hate Obama.
Mm-hmm.
That's the insanity of the situation. That's why they're taking all those pills. Because this man works as a pharmacist. And you read the national, the upper class in Birmingham, Alabama, taking all these opiates, okay, all up on this dope. And they've studied. Most of the Trump counties that he win big are these counties where white folks are harming themselves with these drugs, killing themselves, shooting up in bathroom, dying. That deranged. These are the people that's supporting Trump. They have studied it. They've tested the boats in those counties that's dominated by this plague of drugs. Are the same counters that's going for Trump big time. Draw your own conclusion, Brother Email.
Well, Norman Chomsky says that this is our great fear. And I don't like to use race when we talk in the public square because I don't think it's appropriate. What I'm saying is we have been chosen by qualifications, historical, and if all we would accept it. Imam said it's going to come a time when people in America are going to come to us. And he said it will be rich and powerful and come and ask us to lead this country. I don't think we're too far from it. What I see on the political stages today doesn't give me much confidence that any of these people can lead us.
Well, it's coming. We got to remember now in advanced periodicals, one of our own is being touted as the next Obama. We just have to be aware. First of all, you got to get that big anti-communist, and then you become big friends with China and trade with them, anti-Muslim. Now you're going to see from that anti, in a few years, a big pro-Muslim thing in order to make up for going to the extreme. But unlike the Cold War, it's not going to take 4 or 5 decades before they kiss and make up with a detente with Muslims the way they did with the communist world. That's coming. And you're going to find that these attitudes are going to flip. And those who are supportive of Imam Muhammad, they're going to have an excellent opportunity to influence this landscape. And if there's any bubbles left that's taking these drugs because they missed the drug of white supremacy, we're going to try to reach down in the ditch, Brother Imam, and teach them civilization. That's how we'll do it, brother.
And I want to ask you this. It seems to me that many of our, that's what you experienced at your message, that it seems that many of our Muslim leaders and some of our following are drunk. I've gotten drunk on the wines of the old world of Islam. And if they're so drunk and they're reeling from that intoxication that they can't see the clear, sober teaching of Imam Waqidi Muhammad, And as a result of the fact, they can't get outside these massages and teach the people in Buttermilk Bottom, Vine City. I mean, I don't want to name, because I'll start naming cities, and I know all these cities, too, and I know that the leaders in these cities aren't doing any work at all. The people around them, I was in a big city, one of the most important cities in this country, in terms of the Associate Imam W.D. Muhammad, and I told a brother, I said, you said this is the great imam? Let me ask Bubba right down the street here at the liquor store, does he know where the mosque is? So I said, hey, brother, how you doing? And he cooked the brother,
I got a word that I'm standing some people up at a meeting.
Oh yes, sir.
At a restaurant here.
We're gonna let you go.
We really had a outstanding discussion. I wish we had time for one or two questions. You probably don't see it on the board. I don't know, but if there are any questions, we need to respect that and answer one or two. Otherwise, I have to go and meet this appointment.
All right, yes, sir. Let's see. Is there anybody who would like to ask questions? We got one brother. I believe we have him out of. Brother, did you have a question in 732-927? Question for our leader, I mean, an imam of Selma, Alabama. 732-927.
I thought you had a question. Talk about this. Is he making a statement,
brother? Email. I'm asking that the brother has a question. I thought maybe I don't know whether I'm getting colorblind or not. I thought the board was lit. We had a question mark for a question from that number. Dear brother, did you have a question? A comment? But now we will, okay. All right, well, with those words, we're going to say good evening to you and peace be on you and assalamu alaikum and peace and blessings upon our noble and honorable listening audience. You will see you tomorrow at 7 o'clock. We'll be hosted by Alfred Y. Muhammad. He's going to host the show tomorrow. Sunday, I will see you at 3 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. On Religion Means a Lie. Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. Until tomorrow, see you. Thank you, Brother Imam.